When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Everybody, welcome to this week's episode of the Elise Glink Show. I'm Elise Glink, and I'm here to help you make smart choices about your financial life. But first, here's my Glinkonomics report. This week, my guest Alan Weiss will be sharing some very interesting insights about the tremors he's seeing in the housing market with his new Weiss Index metric. Of course, last week I had Jonathan Smoke tell me that the housing market looks to him to be rock solid. And I'm wondering a little bit about whether these two are going to be in conflict. I want to take note of the hard data for a moment to remind us how far the housing market has actually come to date before we start worrying about where it's going to be next month. So the numbers are still super promising. CoreLogic reported that foreclosure numbers for June were down again in a big way. Foreclosure inventory dropped nationwide by almost 30% from a year ago, June a year ago. And completed foreclosures were down about 15% over the same time period. CoreLogic found that distressed sales are down considerably as well, dropping to under 10% of overall sales for the first time since 2008. That is amazing. Now, some markets are certainly faring better than others, but the overall general trend is promising. So although I'm worried I may hear some potentially sobering predictions in my interview today, it's nice to know that we'll be nearing some semblance of a full recovery before we need to deal with the next crisis. All right, as I already mentioned, my guest this week is Alan Weiss. He's the founder and CEO of Weiss Residential Research, which is now known as Weiss Analytics. He's just launched a new home price index, which is really more of a home price trend index, and it could very well be a game changer in the real estate industry. So he's going to tell us all about that. Then he's going to give us those predictions I alluded to earlier about the health and strength of the housing market and what he's concerned about. He is using the data generated by his new index, and I'm super excited to hear what it's revealing to him. Because one of the things that I've seen him do when I met him face-to-face in Miami a couple of months ago for the NARI event that I attended, I watched him show a video that showed, based on his research, how the housing crisis spread, starting in California, across the entire state. So it'll be really interesting to see how he's extrapolated that for the rest of the country. After my chat with Alan, I've got some advice to a home seller whose realtor assured her that her house will sell very quickly. That's good, and houses are selling very quickly. She's wondering if there's any reason for her to continue making mortgage payments, giving the realtor's confidence. Let's just say that there's an old saying about counting your chickens that might apply here. But you're going to want to hear the rest of my advice as well, because there's actually a bit of a trick to this and you got to think it through. Again, I'm always about the strategy. Then I want to finish up with a short segment on home warranties. And I'm guessing that some of you may not really have a full grasp of what a home warranty will actually cover. And by here, we're talking about existing home warranties, not new home warranties that a builder would give you. This is an existing home warranty, and it is super confusing when you throw homeowners insurance into the mix. So stay tuned until the end of the show to hear who I think should consider purchasing a home warranty and why. All right, that's the lineup for today's show. Let's get started. My guest today is Alan Weiss. He is founder and CEO of Weiss Analytics. He also previously co-founded Case-Shiller Weiss. That may sound familiar to you. And they developed the Case-Shiller Home Price Index that's still commonly used today. But the regional retrospective trends tracked by Case-Shiller HPI failed to actually predict the housing market crash of 2008, although in retrospect, it kind of explained it. That motivated Alan to develop a new and improved index that not only does a better job, he says, of predicting the future direction of home prices, but apparently could be on the verge of being able to do so on a house-by-house basis, which would be pretty remarkable. So I'm anxious to hear, and I know you are, all about the new secret sauce and what it's revealing about today's state of the housing market. Alan, welcome to the show. So let's start with talking about how Weiss Analytics has created this new index and that why it's so different and than the original Case-Shiller-Weiss Index, which is now 20 years old, why it's different and what it's enabling you to do.
All right, so it's a fundamentally different perspective on the world. When we created the Case-Shiller Index, we had technology that was a breakthrough at the time that let us accurately track the aggregate market at a metro level, and in some cases at a zip code level, which essentially is a summary or average of all the houses in that market and how they're changing in price through time, which is useful to understand in general how markets are doing. But it never gave you a perspective as to how your house was doing, which might be different than the average. So at Weiss Analytics, we decided to crack that problem by applying technology such as predictive analytics and big data techniques that were not available 20 years ago. The reason it was so important, I felt, is because I think that these aggregate indexes, which people then started to think of as applying to their own house, can not pick up on very important trends that you cannot see at that level. You have to go to the house, and a completely new world opens up when you can see things from the house upwards.
So I remember when we were in Miami and you showed me sort of a videoized version of how the housing crisis basically started with a single neighborhood in, I think it was outside of LA, and how it then spread up the West Coast, and then from the West Coast it kind of fanned out across the country, and then the reverse sort of happened when it started to get better in LA and up in San Francisco, and then the green started to spread out across the country. And I know looking backwards is always a lot easier than going forward, but I assume by predictive analytics you mean that you're teaching that algorithm how things move. How accurate is the new index?
It's a completely different order of magnitude. In terms of resolution, we've gone from roughly 6,000 Case-Shiller indexes to 50 million house-specific indexes.
50 million.
That's right. So okay. The information we have about what's going on in the market and therefore where it's going is a completely different world. For example, leading up to the crash, we saw major price indexes continuing to rise, but just rise a little more gently. That was reported. That was all most people understood. And everyone kind of assumed that, well, if the index is rising more gently, then my house must be rising more gently as well. But if you tear off the cover of that and see what's going down at the house level, what was really happening was that not all houses were going up, but more gently. What was actually happening was some houses continued to go up rapidly, and an increasing percent of houses started to fall. And it took 18 months after those houses started to fall before the aggregate indexes that were being reported were actually starting to decline. So there was an 18-month warning that nobody had if they had been able to see what was going on at a granular level.
So that's really interesting, the idea that you might have an 18-month window of time, canary properties, you might call it, simply because real estate doesn't move that quickly. It's one thing to take 1,000 shares of stock and you can unload it in an afternoon, or even if you have an index mutual fund, you can unload it once a day at the end of the day, or an ETF where you can unload it momentarily. But to unload a house can take actually quite a lot of time. And, you know, if you are just a couple of days on the wrong side of that, you know, you might not be able to unload it at all. And so many people found themselves holding houses they couldn't afford, couldn't get rid of them almost at any price during the Great Recession. It would have been very useful to have something like that. Now, what do you think is going to happen going forward? Because I know you've now applied this and you've said that this new index is predictive for individual properties 12 months into the future. What are you seeing now going into the future?
Well, that's what's a little disturbing to me, is that when I read the reports in the press, the general message going out there is that sales are up, prices are continuing to rise, maybe a little more slowly, but the market's generally very healthy. But when I look at a graphic image of the entire market, yes, if you look at it, there's more greenhouses, meaning rising, than red houses falling. But I have to say, in the past year, we've gone from essentially zero houses falling to some, depending on the market, somewhere between 10 and 40% of the houses falling. That is not a healthy indicator for the market.
10 to 40% in an individual marketplace where it's falling, or is it more 10 to 40% of the markets across the country? Exactly, what are you seeing?
All right, well, I just recently did an analysis of 10 major markets. And what we did was calculate the percent of houses that were declining at least 2% a year ago, and then look at those same markets now and answer the same question. What's the percentage of houses declining at least 2%? And for example, a typical middle-level market like Phoenix had 5% of its houses declining a year ago and now have 22% of its houses declining. And I see this across the board. I studied 10 important metros, and in each case, the percent of houses declining has increased. In a very strong market like Denver, it went from 0.5% to 3%. But in a very weak market like Washington, D.C., it went from 14% declining to 45% declining. And even in D.C., with 45% declining, the average will be up. It'll just be a gentle up. But people make the assumption that, oh, if they hear that the market's up a little bit, that must be true of their house. And nothing could be further from the truth.
So some of the things that you've published say that this pattern you're seeing is reminiscent of the period right before the crash 10 years ago. 10 years ago was 2005. It was the height of the market. It seemed like all the prices were just rising and nothing was falling. What was going on in 2005?
Well, it's really fascinating. You had a mental habit of thinking of the market as only rising. Mm-hmm. And if you study maps that show each house individually, you can see that the red houses, the ones that were declining, began in various pockets, while the rest of the market was dark green, rising rapidly. And the people who were buying the houses in the dark green areas were buying as though the red areas did not exist, even though they could be very close to each other. As the red areas spread, eventually they would like be a domino effect and kind of as a contagion bring about a change in mentality for the markets that were still green. But it was very polarized, and people didn't have good information. So it's like people were living in two different worlds, and the negative world spread across the positive world. But the people in the positive world were bidding up houses, lending on houses at these higher prices, which made the peak higher, the bubble higher, and therefore the crash more severe.
But you had other things that went into it that were different from back then. So 2006, 2007, we started to see some local economies begin to falter. But we had other things going on, right? We had people who earned $50,000 a year who were getting no doc, no info loans for $500,000. We also saw the beginning of a very deep, very painful recession, not just in the U.S., but obviously abroad. And so we had people who were losing jobs, who had always had jobs and really good jobs. How much of these other factors, which are huge for, you know, if you want to talk about it being the all-in-one, right, the big, all-in-one kind of a crash, how does all of that end up factoring into predictive where you're seeing things go today? Because it's one thing to say that home prices have risen a little too high, too fast, right, too high, too fast, mm-hmm. but... Mm-hmm. Interest rates are still super low. They're supposed to start going up next month. How does that factor into maybe the market's pulling back as well? And is it economically driven, meaning people are being paid less, or the debt-to-income ratios are out of whack again, or people are getting mortgages they really can't afford? How much of it is that, or the economy, or just in general, people have spent too much too fast?
Yeah, I think that's a great question because I'm not saying there's an exact parallel by any means. I agree with you that there were other factors that played into the market 10 years ago that are not present today. Today's market doesn't have those core weaknesses that the market did 10 years ago. And I think more than likely, we will not enter into anything near the kind of scenario we had 10 years ago. I agree with you that we don't have the weakness of people on a vast scale getting mortgages they can't afford with rate increases that make them unaffordable. Hopefully, we don't have a scenario of a major world recession going on. I think that the forces at work here are more contained, and that I don't think it's likely that this trend will continue such that all the houses start to fall. I think it's more contained. What I am seeing is that it seems to be very geographically driven. In each major metro area, you have markets that are strong and are staying strong, and other markets that seem to be out of favor and are declining in value. But because most of the sales are happening in the stronger markets, it's kind of like you forget about the weaker markets. So it's a mixed bag. And as long as people are aware of it and make decisions accordingly, I don't see it becoming the kind of problem we had last time.
Well,
But
that's good.
buyers probably should know where the strong markets are, and people who are potentially thinking of selling, if they're in one of those weak markets, I wouldn't want them to take an aggregate index as the final word as an input into what their decision should be as to sell now versus wait.
No, I totally think that that's accurate. I'm wondering how much in the past, probably not going to ask this correctly, but if I'm looking at your map, is it current data? Is it only as accurate as the house was last sold? So if I'm looking at it and I see all the little tiny houses in red, but there's some green around it, what is the date time stamp of that information? Is that the right way to ask that question?
Yeah, it's a great question. Okay, so what we've done is brought the technique that's recognized as the most precise in terms of measuring price change into a new view down to the house. So that technique is known as the repeat sales index technique, which was pioneered by my former partners, Case and Shiller. And at that point, we could apply it to markets. What we've now done is figured out how to apply it to houses. And as you were asking, the houses do not necessarily have to have sold at all. Because what we do is we have a lot of characteristics information on the house. And we will find hundreds of nearby houses that are economically similar across all the characteristics that matter, such as the era in which they were built, number of bedrooms, number of baths, that sort of thing. And we build a set of information on that house made up of hundreds of repeat sales of houses nearby. So the house does not have to have been sold for there to be information up to the most recent sales on that house. We use its neighbors and its similar houses as an indicator for that house, and it turns out to be very accurate. We've tested this, and it does turn out to be very significantly more accurate than a neighborhood or metro area index.
So the forecasts have been measured to be about 74% to 84% accurate, or
Yes.
it's accurate 74% to 84% of the time. So there's 16% to 26% of the time it will not be accurate. But how off would it be?
Well, I mean, our median error, excuse me, 1 year out is just a couple of percent. Now, that's over the entire period that we tested from 1990 through now. So it was a very difficult period with a rapid boom, a bust, a recovery. You can never know exactly if those stats will continue into the future, but we gave it a very challenging test. And the reason it worked is because the system could see other houses nearby and how they are performing. If we had simply used the forecasting technique that we used at Case-Shiller Weiss, which was look at the trend and assume it's going to continue, we would have missed every major turn. And those forecasts did, because all we had in the past was, is the aggregate rising? Okay, assume it's going to continue. This time around, we can actually study the patterns of rising and falling houses around the subject house. And what we find is that if you have a market that have had, say, 100% of the neighbors rising in the past year, and then you go from 100% steadily down to 60% of the houses rising, that is a very strong indicator that there's a high probability that house will continue to become one of those houses in the 40%. It's not a sure thing, but it's a risk. And the reverse is also true. If you have a recovery going on where in the past year 10% of the houses were rising and suddenly it's up to 40% are rising, then it's a very strong indication that you're an upward trend in the market. And that gives us this accuracy that is 60 to 80% of the time within about 2%.
So one thing that I think is interesting that you're finding right now as you're looking at these different markets is that larger homes, and by that I assume you mean more expensive homes or just there are more bedrooms, larger homes are having a tougher time than smaller homes. So are you measuring square footage? Are you measuring neighborhoods? Are you measuring price point? What are you looking at?
Well, that's the beauty of having this kind of information. Each house is a grain of sand, and we know many things. In that particular case, we segmented the market by square feet of house, breaking it into thirds of the smallest third, middle, and upper third. So that's literally, that's a segmentation by the square feet, the gross living area of the house.
Okay. And then the other thing that you and I were talking about sort of off camera was this idea that homes that are located on major train lines or major transportation lines, whether that's bus or train or whatever, commuter lines, those homes are doing better than homes that are farther away from that. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yes, it is. How much that matters depends on the market. But for example, if you look at our metro analysis of Chicago, and you set the time to be, say, this month, August of 2015, it's fascinating because if you draw overlay onto the map Route 90, which is the major commuter highway into Chicago, and then the commuter rails into Chicago, you can see that the houses along those preferred commuter routes are doing better and kind of show green stripes into the city, whereas houses further away from those easy commutes are not doing as well. So that tells you in Chicago, commute time really matters. What I find is that it's very hard to generalize in this market because what's driving the market in different metros seems to vary. But in general, I would say that commute time, distance from the city, matters more now than it used to, as this new ethos of reurbanization has taken hold. For example, in Boston, you see green tight into the city, and then a stripe of red, which used to be the acceptable commute distance of about 20 miles, and then further out, the exurbs turn green again. So these maps can give you this kind of detailed information that you wouldn't know if you just said Boston or Chicago was rising a little bit.
So interesting. So, Alan, your index is in the program itself is currently available to major investors. Soon you're going to bring it to everybody by subscription. Is that the plan?
Actually, it's available to consumers right now.
Ah.
People go on, because it's useful in a number of settings. Yes, we have our hedge fund clients and rating agency clients, but I think it's really the people who it's most useful to are people who are in the process of making a buy or sell decision. So what we have done, for example, is put it on a site where, in partnership with owners.com. And when available, if you see a listing on that site, you will see both the metro map and the zip code map in which that house exists available right when you see the listing. So people can get an immediate sense, is this house in a market that's getting stronger or getting weaker? And if I think about all the pockets of money that are impacted by home prices, it's the buyers and sellers by far that are impacted the most.
Got it. Well, Alan, this has been really interesting, and we're going to have you back, I think, relatively soon so that we can see how the markets are actually moving. Alan Weiss is the founder and CEO of Weiss Analytics. I really appreciate you being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
We'll definitely do it again. Selling a home can be stressful and exciting and confusing all at the same time. but you just can't let the process overwhelm your good judgment. I'm Elise Glink with today's Real Estate Minute. A home seller recently wrote to ask me, should I continue making my monthly mortgage payment now that my home is listed for sale? The agent expects it to sell very quickly. Oy, this is one of those questions that makes me want to tear my hair out. Okay, so maybe your home will sell quickly. Maybe it'll even sell in 24 hours, like my friend Leo's house just did. And then again, it may not, even if your realtor bends over backwards to make it happen. And if you don't make your mortgage payments, or at the time that you're waiting for a buyer, right, your lender could put your house into foreclosure. And you could completely trash your credit history, not to mention losing out on the proceeds from selling. And you can imagine if that extends out and it takes you 2 years to sell, and now you've lost your home because you failed to pay your back taxes. So, in short, you've got to be sure to make your payments each and every month on time up until the month of closing. Now, once the closing date is set, you can decide whether to make your regular monthly payment or wait and arrange for the mortgage to be paid out of the closing proceeds. How do you decide that little thing? Well, it depends on when your mortgage payment is due. Most payments are due on the first of the month, although you typically have a 10 to 15 day grace period. If the closing is set for the 10th of the month or later, you should make your regular mortgage payment. Let me be super clear. I'm going to say it again. Make your regular mortgage payment. But if your closing falls within the first few days of the month, let's say on the 4th, it may make sense to pay the amount due out of the closing proceeds, unless you're able to make your payment by the 25th of the previous month so the check has time to get to the lender, be deposited, and clear before closing. The thing that you don't want to have happen, which I've seen happen to so many people, is you don't want to get to the day of the closing or the day before the closing, and then your attorney says to you, so, did you make your regular payment? And you went, oh no, I was waiting for the closing, and not have that conversation ahead of time. It will change all of the closing documents. And once we get into the Tila Respa era, and you can watch all the videos we've done about that, that may be enough to send your loan back where you need another 3-day period where they're going to disclose things to you, and it could change the lender disclosures, and it can make things a real nightmare. So what you want to do is be super clear up front, right when you're setting the closing date with the lender, make sure everybody knows when you're going to make that last mortgage payment, and then that can be factored in. Remember, if you overpay, you'll get money back, and that's a good thing too. When you're buying a home, you may have the option to purchase a home warranty. The question for you to consider, is it actually worth the cost? I'm Elise Glink, and here's today's Real Estate Minute. Home warranties cover the repair or replacement of broken down mechanical components and appliances in a home. Things like the furnace, air conditioning system, refrigerators, washers, and dryers. And generally, the warranty company will send out a service contractor to repair faulty appliances or systems. If the problem is beyond repair, the company will provide a replacement. In either case, the homeowner will owe a deductible in addition to the cost of the policy, which runs around $500 a year. Now, home warranties are especially beneficial for anyone buying a home with older appliances and mechanical systems, and home sellers might also consider buying a home warranty because the coverage will transfer to a new owner, thereby providing an added incentive to buy, right? You're always trying as a seller to remove those obstacles. You just have to remember that home warranties are not a replacement for homeowners insurance, which covers damage caused by natural disasters or property crimes, right? Home warranties, even though we refer to it as a deductible and we talk about policies, and sometimes it's even covered by the Department of Insurance in your state, is not really an insurance policy. That's why it's important to read the fine print and know what claims would qualify under a given home warranty. For example, it might cover a hot water heater that springs a leak, but not the damage the water does to your house. That would be an insurance issue. Homeowners should also be aware of additional fees and exclusions, and keep in mind that there is always the potential for disagreement on the merits of a claim. Again, there's that insurance language, as well as the brand and model for replacements. I hope everyone enjoyed today's episode, and I especially want to thank Alan Weiss, CEO of Weiss Analytics, again for being on the show. That was really interesting. If there was anything you missed, don't worry. As always, you can find the show notes to this episode at thinklink.com. That's thinkglink.com. And I would love it if you would subscribe to this podcast on iTunes if you haven't already. And heck, go subscribe to my YouTube channel if you haven't done that either, Expert Real Estate Tips. But please consider giving this show a rating or review while you're there, and you can do it by searching for The Elyse Glink Show in the podcast section of iTunes. Well, this brings us to the end of another episode of The Elyse Glink Show. I'm your host, Elyse Glink, still. Thanks for listening, everybody.